as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
The views expressed on this program are those of the hosts and guests and are not necessarily those of IRN, its advertisers, or affiliates.
Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion. That's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views. The views of our guest, and, well, the guest for the first hour is going to be David Sibley. David works for Ready Reserve Foods. He is Ready Reserve Food, and certainly we work with him. They have emergency food supplies they're laying in, and of course they make them available to people all across the country. And really, keeping in touch with David, why most people really are totally unconcerned about the possible threat, I feel a very real threat to the food supply. Now, of course, if you're seeing what's happening in Africa, why they've had a great failure of the wheat crop because of something called a rust in both the Ukraine and Australia. They've had lost a good deal of their wheat because of a drought, one of the worst droughts in 100 years. Here in the United States, of course, why our corn supply is limited. Corn has gone up tremendously because the politicians, in their wisdom, have decided that they're going to use ethanol rather than develop the oil resources we have here in the United States. Oh, we're going to have green energy. And so we're going to have to subsidize ethanol. We have to subsidize it very, very heavily. Now, of course, we could use grass. We could use sugar. But we're not going to do that because Arthur Daniels Midland would not make the profits that they will if we use corn, because Arthur Daniels Midland, which is one of the establishment's concerns, controls most of the corn. So the price of corn has almost doubled as a result. Of course, the price of beef is going up and chicken is going up because both animals, birds and animals, are fed on corn. And, of course, they have to subsidize corn very, very heavily, ethanol very, very heavily to make it competitive. But they subsidize it and then they make it competitive. How can it be competitive if it has to be subsidized? Don't ask me. But certainly all throughout the world there are rumbles, possibilities of food shortages. And then, of course, we go and we look at the book of Revelation, and Revelation 6:8 says, you know, and I look and behold a pale horse, and the rider upon him is death. And Hades followed close behind, and power was given unto them to kill a quarter of the population of the earth by the sword, and with famine and pestilence and the beasts of the earth. And people can't imagine we could ever have famine here. We've always had, well, we've always been a land of abundance. And yet, of course, we can look at China. We know they had a famine there between 1958 and 1962 that is never mentioned in America. And remember, I was getting started in this whole anti-communist crusade back in 1962, and yet I never had heard of the Great Chinese Famine, where between 41 and 43 million Chinese died during that period. All news of that mentioned of it totally blocked out here in the United States. Between 41 and 43 million Chinese died in that four-year period. Well, David, tell us, how are the food supplies? Are there any shortages here at the present time? David, David Sibley, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. That's good.
Okay.
I could just faintly hear you in the background. Now, what was the question, sir?
I see. Are there any shortages? Are you running into any shortages at all?
One of my suppliers right now is complaining about getting sweet corn. There is so much effort being devoted to field corn for conversion to ethanol that the sweet corn market is basically tapped out. As a matter of fact, he was even showing me samples of imported sweet corn. So that's where we stand on that.
Yeah, what about rice? Because we hear about, of course, the rice crop in the San Joaquin Valley being contaminated by the genetically engineered rice. And what is the danger from eating the genetically engineered rice?
Nobody really knows. But a lot of people won't touch the rice because of that reason, because no one knows. California rice hasn't got a very good reputation at the moment, and a lot of people seem to be distancing themselves from any association with California rice.
Well, now, I understand you get your rice from Arkansas, but is there any of the genetically engineered rice in Arkansas?
Not that I can find out, and they actually tout that their rices are not genetically modified. And they're working very hard to keep that out.
Well, you know, Chris, we have genetically engineered soy, we have genetically engineered corn, we have genetically engineered cottonseed, and I guess canola. Those are the four crops here in the United States that are genetically engineered, and we know that at least on some of them, the large-scale tests do show certain, at least in animals, a certain damage to the organs. All of this is being carefully covered up by Monsanto, and the other people have used them, and every effort is being made to conceal the truth about the animal experiments from the human beings. But what about long-term human use of these genetically engineered crops? Do we have any studies to show that they're safe?
No one has, that I've not been able to find, no. But there's a thought that genetically modified food may be the cause why the bees are dying off.
Well, what do we know about the bees?
Not much. Recently there has not been a whole lot of news or publications about the bee die-off. It got kind of quiet. But what's concerning me at the moment is spring has come and gone. The bees had a job to do. They were to pollinate. And we should be getting to orchardmen should be seeing the fruits of the bees' work. In other words, there should be trees heavily laden with fruits that are going to ripen over the summer and pick. Well, there's been no, shall we say, sounding of the all clear. Nobody's talking. Nobody, at least that I can find. And I daily go out and look for someone or some publication or editorial one way or the other. And the silence is deafening, so I'm very worried about it.
We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and David, because, of course, his business is food, has been keeping his ear close to the ground. He tells us that there seems to be, at least with one of his suppliers, a shortage of sweet corn, and they're, in fact, even importing it from other countries. I hope we're not importing it from China.
Oh, no, I hope not. The bad news coming out of China about their quality control and their standards is all over the internet and the newspapers these days.
All right, well, where would we be importing our sweet corn from if they don't have it here?
I'd probably somewhere in Europe or maybe South America. I didn't ask. All I saw was the little tag on the sample that said imported sweet corn, and when I gave him the stink eye, he knew that I wasn't about to get near that, so.
All right, fine. Well, certainly there is corn here, isn't there, if you pay enough for it?
Yes, I would think it's available to me in the amounts I need it, but what's happening is the cost of corn, or sweet corn, or corn in general, is beginning to just ripple through act like a tsunami, through the cost of food. I heard you earlier talking about the price of chickens going up. Chickens eat a lot of corn. The price of corn has doubled in the last year and a half, and that has an effect on everything. Corn sweeteners, even corn syrups that are used in soft drinks and the liquids. We're on the verge of a major disaster as food costs go up and up. People don't have the excess money to have to pay double now, or quickly approaching double, for their food, daily food costs. Something has to give in their life, and that would be other, shall we say, wants.
All right. Well, now, Chris, then we, of course, get down to the genetically modified foods. The Europeans will not allow genetically modified food in, and the reason is because a friend of ours, Josie McDonald, who is an Englishwoman, has actually gotten hold of the animal studies on the genetically modified foods and found that, at least in the animal studies, there was significant damage to the white count, to the kidneys, as I remember. There were several organs, both the bone marrow and the kidneys had been damaged. And, of course, Monsanto and the drug companies were doing, genetically modified companies, had done everything they could to conceal the truth. And the Europeans said, no way. You've got to show this is really safe before we want it. And, oh, Monsanto says, you don't think we'd give you something that wasn't safe? Well, everybody knows, of course, they've given us aspartame that certainly produces tumors and tumors of all sorts and diabetes that actually produces pathological obesity, affects the fertility, upsets the endocrine system, leads to epilepsy and convulsions. This is Monsanto, and they released that. They licensed for many years aspartame, but because they have such control over the media and such control over the people who work in the FDA, most people don't understand. Monsanto has done tremendous harm to the American people. We hear about how this obesity epidemic, well, they know from animal studies that aspartame, NutraSweet, will produce pathological obesity. So now they want us to believe them as far as their animal studies on the genetically modified food. Now, right now, of course, we have a genetically modified canola oil. We have cottonseed because we use cottonseed oil. We have wheat and, pardon me, we have corn and soybeans. And, of course, here in the United States, because of these corporations control the government and the FDA, you're not even allowed to know whether you're getting genetically modified food. Whereas in Europe, they won't allow it. Here, you can't even learn, and they're not allowed to tell you, the producers, that this is not genetically modified. So we do not know how much damage they're doing to the health of the American people. But the latest thing, of course, is the genetically modified rice. And, of course, they told the farmers, look, there's nothing to worry about. We can plant genetically modified rice, and it will not spread to the adjacent fields. You can trust us. Well, of course, they lied. And, of course, because rice is pollinated by the wind, of course, they contaminated most of the rice in the state of California. And David was saying that California rice is not looked upon very kindly, and most places in the world will not import California rice because it's all contaminated with this genetically modified rice that is not cleared for human consumption. What are they doing with these rice crops? Do you have any idea, David?
No, I do not. Somebody's purchasing them, or they're being put into mixes somewhere, but I do not know. All I know is that where I purchase my rice in Arkansas, they're very proud of the fact that it is not genetically modified.
So we do not know how much damage they're doing to the food crops in the United States with the genetic modifications and what they're putting into them. And the American people are not being told the truth, that's for certain.
And they don't really know where these modifications are going. They're going to the surrounding plants. I know there are certain... God, I wish I could remember. I read a study. There's a plant that's associated with the rice. It grows near rice paddies, and it's gotten into that here in California.
What sort of harm does it do? We have any idea?
Don't know. I don't. It's a weed, basically. And but the traits that were in the rice were showing up in the weeds.
And we know, Chris, that apparently it gets into some bacteria. These genetic traces in the rice have gotten into bacteria. And as somebody had pointed out, they're in the bacteria in the gut of the bees. Now, whether this has any part at all in the fact that the honeybees are disappearing, we don't know. David was saying, we do not yet know whether or not the disappearance of the honeybees has affected the pollination of the fruit crops here in California. We're one of the largest fruit producers in the nation, and right now everything is very silent. I know in my little orchard of citrus trees, they seem to all be doing fine. We did have bees here, but where is the major defect as far as the honeybees is concerned? Do we have any idea?
Well, again, it's all over the board. They're dissecting dead bees, and they're finding numerous problems with them. They're stunned. Now, are those problems caused by stress that are brought on by, say, genetic modification, pollens that are in plants that are have insecticides in them, combination of insecticides? Which came first here, the chicken or the egg? Are the diseases causing the bees to die, or is the genetic modifications or combinations of insecticides causing the bees to develop these maladies and expire that way? But either way, the end result is still the same. The bees are dying, and they have literally a job to do, which is to pollinate the food that feeds us. California produces 25% of this nation's food, and on a year-round basis, without bees, again, like I mentioned earlier, I've been waiting for orchard men or the farm community, agriculture community, to smile like the bee did their job. Even though they might have been short in number, they got the job done. Nobody is saying there's nothing on the subject. I may even attempt to take a few days off and go up into the San Joaquin Valley and just look around and walk around and ask people questions.
Well, apparently the bees are responsible for pollinating about a third of our food, and that would be primarily the fruits. And what about vegetables? Do they pollinate vegetables too?
Basically, if a plant has a flower, it's looking for a pollinator. That's the good rule of thumb. I guess you'd look at it that way. It's trying to attract a pollinator, which would be a bee or even be a wasp or a hummingbird. But generally, the bees do the most of the work.
All right. Well, of course, there are about three theories as to why the honeybees are disappearing. One, it's a pesticide. Two, it's a genetic modification. Three, it's a cell phone. It's the electronic atmosphere. Now, because we've had the cell phones and the cell phone towers around for a long time, certainly there are new pesticides that have been introduced, but nobody really knows. All we do know is if the bees continue disappearing, this could have a dramatic effect on the availability of fruit in the years to come. Would that be a fair statement?
Very fair. And it could be a combination of a bunch of things. It could also be what they refer to as monoculture, where you have just a sea, miles of the same type of plant. The bee doesn't have any diversity in his pollen, and he gets different things from different pollens or nectars and stuff. So that could be one of the major stresses on the bee. In other words, when you go to parts of California where all you can see is just almond trees from any direction you look, well, a bee has an effective range of 3 miles usually. It will go a little further, but generally 1 mile to 3 miles. Well, if all he can get is pollen from almond trees in that radius, he may be deficient in something, which could be part of one of the stresses that go along with getting them in this condition where they begin to perish.
But this is such an unusual phenomenon. We've never seen anything quite like this before, where, you know, in many instances, you know, 50-75% of a beekeeper's bees are just disappearing. They're not coming back again, and nobody really knows why. Now, why are all these things happening at this time in history? Is this simply an accident, or is this foreshadowing some very, very serious problems as far as food's concerned? Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But sadly, one of the, and I've forgotten who it was who said it, but they commented that with the bees began to disappear, why, of course, it won't take long before the fruits will begin to disappear as well. Give us a call if you have a question, a comment. David knows a lot more about this than I do, and we'll be back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty talking about food and famine and the future.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four-tape or a four-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that will protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Teary. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
of the Mormons was always they would have a two-year food supply. But David was saying that recently the leaders of the church have been really stressing the importance of getting that food supply on hand, almost as if they were anticipating a major crisis. Would that be a fair statement?
That appears to be the gist without them coming out and saying it, yes. And a lot of people have there within their church have begun to heed the message, but my conversations with them, the other members of the church are not doing that, and they're perplexed why, because the message is pretty strong. There's a Mormon church sponsored website that basically comes out and tells them to do this very strongly, and it's just out recently. I'm sorry I can't give you that website right now, but they're pushing. Now, that's all I can tell you is they're pushing their people to get prepared.
Now, what sort of things should people have on hand? Should they have wheat? Should they have rice? Should they have corn? Should they have all of the above? Should they have ready prepared meals? How can you get ready prepared meals that don't have a lot of MSG or certainly other preservatives like that in them? What is the major staples that people should have on hand, say, to prepare for 3 or 6 months where we might have difficulty getting food?
Well, the grains, yes. Rice, corn, wheat. If you have wheat, you're going to convert wheat probably to flour for baking, so you're going to have a hand-operated grain mill. You can convert that to flour, then use it to bake your breads. But you're going to have, if you can't live completely on just on grains, you're going to have dry vegetables and carbohydrates, proteins, sugars, all of those things. You need to store sugar. You can make a lot of things a lot better with sugar. If you go to our website, readyreservefoods.com, you can see the products we sell is a good broad stroke of the things you should be storing. Store a lot of the things that you like, that you are in your daily diet. Trying to think, things that have a long shelf life. If you're going to do wet pack foods, good quality cans, good quality food, and rotate that food out. Canned goods are great, but you, again, things in cans that have high acid contents, they tend to last a lot shorter period of time. The acid begins to attack the lining of the can. For instance, if you buy tomato paste or powders or liquids, always buy those in glass because they won't attack the glass. Oh, my, what things would you want to store? Fruits, vegetables, anything. But they'll have to be in a dried form because, a fruit won't last that long. Did you there? Dr. Stan?
Which gives you the longest acting, Cindy, the dried or the freeze-dried?
Well, freeze-dried food is a form of dehydrating food. And there's another form of dehydrating food which we use, which is low heat drying. Freeze drying is an excellent process, but it's very expensive. Low heat dehydration is substantially less expensive, and they both have a tendency to have about the same shelf lives. Some people like freeze dried foods; they tend to maybe rehydrate just a little bit faster. But some of them cost 2 and 3 times the cost of low heat dehydration, so it becomes cost ineffective for any gains. The way I see it, any gains that you might gain, dehydrated food will store comfortably 10 years. If you store it properly, you can get 15 years out of it in cool, dry places. So it should always be there for you when you need it.
All right, fine. So basically, people probably should have some things on hand that will last a good long time because you can get the things down at the store, but so many of the things you get in cans at the store are not prepared to last for a long period of time, and with many of them, of course, the acid in the and the products will begin to attack the can or the lining of the can. Anyway, if you have any questions or comments, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Is there a problem? Should people begin making preparations for it? What really would happen if there would be a major crisis in America tomorrow? Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is David Sibley. David, what preparations has the government made to look after people if there is a major problem? Does the Red Cross have large food supplies? Does the Salvation Army have large food supplies? But what about local civilian defense?
Answer to all of the above, no. There, nobody is prepared in government. One thing that I have basically gleaned, hospitals and government agencies have recently, and I mean like in the last week or so, have been doing disaster drills and preparation drills for a bird flu pandemic. There was, I guess, the World Health Organization has recently come out and said that the bird flu is mutating very, very, very rapidly, and it's really making them nervous now. So, and then coinciding with that, the hospitals have begun to do emergency drills, but this country is so ill-prepared to go without support for a week or two. It's unbelievable. The government is basically not doing a whole lot more. They're doing a lot of talking, but talk is cheap, and there are no food stores, much food stores stored by the government anywhere. And in a pandemic or a disaster, well, let's just take a look at Katrina. How ham-handed and clumsy their reaction to that was. And I guess one picture says 1,000 words.
All right, fine. Well, Chris, I was just at a doctor's meeting before I came up here, and of course many of the doctors I'd practiced with for years were commenting that the local public health officials had been trying to recruit a doctor's corps, and the whole idea was that there was a major epidemic. They would want doctors and nurses to come down and start giving vaccinations. And I commented, I didn't sign up for that because if there was a major epidemic, I wouldn't want to go out and take a chance on catching the disease. I would want to quarantine myself in my home. But you go down and you're around a lot of people, that's how you'd get the disease yourself. And since we're not sure that the vaccines, we don't know anything about them, certainly they'd be totally experimental. Do I really want to give an experimental vaccine to millions of Americans, knowing the track record of the public health agencies with experimental vaccines in the past? For instance, the yellow fever, the vaccine that we gave to our troops during the Second World War, we didn't have very many cases of yellow fever, but we lost an awful lot of people from the yellow fever vaccine during the Second World War, and that's just one of many vaccine failures. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this evening is David Sibley, and we would welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And I was asking David, is there, you know, any major supplies of food on hand for emergencies? And David replies, well, the Red Cross and the Salvation Army and the Civil Defense really aren't laying in supplies. And because he's on the front lines of this because they sell large quantities of certainly long-term food storage. So to your knowledge then that the Civil Defense agencies and FEMA and the others are not laying in long-term food supplies for the people?
None at all. None at all. None. That's all I can tell you is none. They're telling people to do it themselves. They want you to have a 3-day food supply. They're actually talking a little bit about wanting to up that, but nobody is taking heed. And let's go back to a pandemic. Let's say the bird flu modifies.
Well, because you were just saying that the World Health Organization had put out a directive that they were concerned that the bird flu was modifying and that there could be a worldwide epidemic, and that many of the local public health agencies, just as last week, have been holding drills on how they would deal with a worldwide epidemic. And certainly I know that to be true. I know that they are having these drills all across the country, almost as if they know something is going to happen. We know, for instance, the CDC actually had a program. They were working to see if they could make the bird flu, which of course is primarily infects birds, but if they could get it to infect human beings, become much more lethal. And they were actually able to make it about 35,000 times more lethal. Why would anybody in their right mind want to make the bird flu 35,000 times more lethal? Well, of course, the answer to that is very simple. They're not in their right mind. There really are people working in the scientific community working to make these diseases more transmittable and more lethal. And we have to ask ourselves, why would any rational person do that? But anyway, of course, David, you were saying that they really seem to be concerned about this?
Yes, they do. And as a matter of fact, just recently I was perusing the Department of Defense pandemic plan, basically is what it amounts to, is what they're charged to do and how they're going to handle it and how it's going to be structured. It's like they're getting everything, they're getting all dressed up for a dance that no one has an invitation to, or is there going to be a surprise party? I don't know. It's very frightening. But the other problem, and how it's going to affect your listeners, other than the fact that they could become ill and even perish, is everything will grind to a halt. Everything. Truck drivers are going home, and they're not going to be delivering food, and everyone's going to go home and stay out of harm's way. I mean, you even talked about, why should I go down there and expose myself to a higher degree of a risk of getting, say, this bird flu, if it exists. Eventually, around enough people, you will get it. And the vaccines are untried and true. So there's going to, with the pandemic, will be a panic and total chaos. And the best way for your listeners and everyone to survive that is not to be in the fray when that happens. And you do that by being prepared, to be able to sit out, ride out, sit it out without having to go out. You even talked about how you would quarantine yourself in the house and stay out of the path of this thing.
And I think that if there is a major epidemic, that's what you'd want to do. Now, Sydney, I think everybody who's really concerned about themselves and their family should get up on the Internet and go and look at the special presidential directives that were issued on the 9th of May. You'll find them on the president's webpage. The National Security Presidential Directive, I think that's 51, and the Homeland Security Presidential Directive, 20. And you'll find those on up on the Internet and at whitehouse.gov. And it gives the president complete power of a military dictator in the United States whenever he wants to declare a dictatorship. In case of an emergency, in case of a pandemic, in case of some sort of either a storm, in case of a natural disaster, in case of a chemical, biological, or nuclear attack, the president has taken to himself, without the authority of Congress, and in total violation of our Constitution, to become a dictator. If you doubt it, you go up and you pull those things down. Understand now that he's done away with the Posse Comitatus Act so that he can use the American troops against American citizens. They now, of course, have their mercenary force under Blackwater and several of the other, Diebold and several of the other corporations, where they have professional mercenaries that can be used to control the American people. They, of course, are paying $385,000 a year to Halliburton to be prepared to build concentration camps. Why are they doing all of these things? What are they preparing for? Ladies and gentlemen, they're preparing to look after themselves. There are supplies, there are centers for the elite, but there are none for the general population.
Can you hold right there?
Yes.
The Greenbrier Club outside of Washington, D.C. It was a country club, America's Secret Bunker. Underneath it was a bunker, basically, for the Cold War, where Congress and all the elected officials in D.C. can go. And I've seen on the Discovery Channel, I've seen exposés of it, and it's literally an underground city where our leaders can hole up. Well, the Cold War came and went. Well, they have just recently spent millions and millions and millions of dollars refurbishing that. And it's back in full swing. It's ready to receive our elected officials, just like during the Cold War. You have to ask yourself, why? What do they know that we don't?
This time in history would they refurbish that? And why are they making preparations to take care of the elite, but not the general population?
I don't know. It sure doesn't give you a warm feeling, does it?
It sure doesn't.
The message isn't getting down to what you see and hear versus what they're saying are two different things. They don't go hand in hand here. So what I'm urging is your listeners is to call Dr. Stan. He can supply you with Ready Reserve foods, or call Ready Reserve. What makes our food better is it doesn't require refrigeration. Should there be a pandemic, you might as well figure the electricity is going to go out at some point. It will store and transport very easily, and it'll last a long time. So it should be just a one-time purchase. It's whatever you do, start preparing. The droughts that are affecting this nation and the globe, for that matter, can have devastating effects on our crop yields come this fall. And let's mind the summer, because if we have another scorching summer like, say, South Dakota went through last summer, the crops could just wilt and die, and there may be very little food for us to eat next fall or next winter.
Well, let's our telephone again is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, and let's go to Jeannie, who's calling. Hi, Jeannie, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. I was wondering if David came across this. About a month ago, I read that the United States government, they had created a vaccine for a pandemic bird flu scenario, but they were not going to distribute it to the hospitals and the doctors. They were going to store this new created vaccine for the bird flu. They felt that it was, you had to take too much of the vaccine, and they wanted to refine it, and so you would not take as much of the vaccine. And, of course, then my concern is, what are they planning? And, David, have you heard about this new vaccine?
A little bit. There's only so many hours in a day to study all the threats, but yes, I did. But then again, why are they storing it? A lot of good it's going to do me here in Southern California if I need it, and it's in, let's say, Chicago, Illinois.
What better way to kill off the people of the world and blame it on a pandemic? This is really...
Exactly. Their failures are placed they create a natural disaster.
Right. Chris, one of the things I recommend that everybody do is get a copy of Tom Clancy's thriller, Rainbow Six, and read it through from beginning to end. It's one of the typical Tom Clancy shoot 'em up, as Tom Clancy says in the foreword to the book, this book contains real information that the people in government don't want you to know about, and it all has to do with creating an epidemic, and that, of course, frightening the people into taking a vaccine. And the vaccine is designed to kill off the majority of the world's population.
That was a great book. Everyone should read it. And it was interesting of the different characters of Rainbow Six.
Right.
Where at that particular time when it came out, Carol Browner was the head of the EPA. And they actually had her name, but they changed a few letters. And so the characters were real, but they changed the letters of the names so they came out a little bit different. So thanks again, Dr. Stan, for having the program.
Hey, thank you so much. Well, let's go to Barbara calling. And again, our telephone number is 1-888 888-24-LIBERTY. 888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And if you have any questions, comments, you don't think there's anything to worry about, nothing like that could ever happen in America, well, that's fine. But I fear that something is going to happen, and I don't care whether you get your food, but make your preparations. Learn what you need. You need water. You need water storage. You need food. You need shelter. You need a means of staying warm. And you need to start thinking about how you'd survive if you turned on the faucet or there wasn't any water. If you couldn't get to the store, or you got to the store and there really weren't any supplies of food there, because believe me, when the crisis comes, the trucks are not going to be rolling and there's going to be food shortages. Think about it. Could it happen? If God is just, would he allow that to happen to America? Hi, Barbara. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. I appreciate everything that David is talking about and he's doing. You did just a follow-up to actually now to what you were saying as far as the food supply itself and the stores is concerned. You go down after a long weekend and a lot of the food, a lot of those shelves are pretty empty. And because people, you know, the stores don't stock the foods like they used to. They used to have a good supply. But now they rely on the trucking to come, you know, in and out every, you know, two or three days. You cut off that supply, and it would not take long for those shelves to empty out. And we live in earthquake country, and believe me, it doesn't take long after an earthquake, and there is no supplies coming in or out for those shelves to empty out. And I don't think people really understand that there just is not the inventory kept in stores that there used to be.
Just-in-time delivery, it's called.
Yeah.
And actually, the other thing, since we're on, there's not enough in the stores, the entire food store, when I say food store, from the agricultural end, from start to finish, is against the hilt now. There is no excess production. The Earth's population grows by 250,000 people net a day. Not just 250,000 births, that's after you take off those that have passed away. Well, every one of those people require food, water, and oil. Okay, oil is a component in the other things they consume. Oil is a component in the food they consume. It's paying for, you know, running tractors and stuff like that, and delivering the food to them on trucks. So we're in a real quandary right now. And now you need more and more of potentially less and less as the drought takes effect. And this drought is a lot worse. Lake Superior, I was reading, is down 30 inches. That's a lot of water. It hasn't, you know, they've even got a rain problem in Minnesota. The dryness in Arizona, Idaho has been in a drought condition of 7 of the last 8 years. Alabama, Florida is in just epic drought. Texas was up in central Texas now is under, what, they got almost 20 inches of rain here in the last few days. Now they're up to their eyeballs in water. The weather patterns are getting such that we don't have predictable weather patterns to maintain a steady food supply. And this is where I think our biggest single problem is going to come from, is crop failures.
And, of course, it is said that we have the lowest supplies we've ever had on hand. We have about 56 days' worth of food. We haven't had food supplies this low for going back to the early 70s.
Doctor, I read the other day where it's as little as 41.
Really?
Yes. Plus, now we're competing against the ethanol, corn being converted to ethanol. We're competing against the automobile for food. I also read that within about 15 years at this rate, 25% of our farmland will be committed to growing corn for ethanol. Well, now you're competing against your car. But the earlier caller, Jeannie, when she talked about the vaccine that they're supposedly storing, now what I can remember from biology and virology, what little I have, don't you have to have the specific virus to create the vaccine for?
You do have to have it. If it's not the specific virus, it doesn't work. For instance, you can have the influenza vaccine, but they usually get it for the wrong subtype. In fact, usually the influenza vaccine does no good at all. It does a great deal of harm because it has thimerosal in it, and its effect, of course, is to destroy the minds of our youth and, of course, to precipitate Alzheimer's in our elderly. And they know that, and in my estimation, that's exactly why they're giving it, because from a medical point of view, it has never been shown to restrict the death, significantly. But I'll tell you, it does a great deal of harm. And if you're looking, and since I do not trust our public health authorities, why, of course, and having seen what a terrible job they did with the AIDS epidemic and with so many of the other things, and the fact that they are not honest, I realize they have a different worldview. Many of the people in key positions in public health and at the CDC look at the world differently than you and I do. Barb, do you have anything else you want to say before we let you go?
Just one other thought is the fact that we live in a major agricultural area, and they are working very hard to transfer a lot of this agricultural land into housing projects, and that is going to cut down also on the production of food. So, you know, it behooves people to really stop and think.
Now, you know, Doctor, that brings to mind something about the California rice.
Right.
All right. Makes that property a little more valuable for homes and less valuable for farming.
Well, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens with these genetically modified foods. We may not know until people start dying by the tens of thousands. Thanks, Barbara. Well, David, we got about 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts are, I'm urging everyone, again, whether you buy ready reserve food, it makes no difference. The peace of mind that you're going to have when you have yourself a store of food that you know you can fall back on should everything crater and fall apart, you'll feel better about yourself, and your family will look on you like you were some sort of hero when you were prepared and weren't one of the ones out in the street in a panic just running around obtaining nothing, and you're out of harm's way, and let the things happen that are going to happen, and you and your family survive by being prepared. And the other side of this is, if you don't, if it never comes to fruition, you can eat it. It's not a waste. You're going to eat every day of your life. So just rotate this food out, but just make sure that your storehouse is full, because any little thing at this point could set us off. A bad crop yield this year because of the drought, the water, that's, like I said, that's the one that scares me the most. A pandemic, terrorism, or even something engineered by our own government. There could be elements of our own government trying to engineer something to allow all of these dictates that the government, that the president has just decided he's gonna do, and the powers as a dictator, put them into play. So the future is really, really, really bleak. So prepare yourselves and your family and go on with life.
All right, well, I think that's very good advice. Our guest this evening has been David Sibley, and we've certainly been talking about the potential for a food crisis, potential for a crisis here in our country. Now, we know that here in California, Maria Shriver, who is a governor's wife, has been going on to television urging people to begin making preparations. Why would she do this? And of course, these are played night after night after night for about 3 months, just saying, go to this special website, begin laying in the supplies that you would need. Are we talking about, would you need supplies for a week, for a month, for 3 months? You're going to have to decide, but I think the longer you're prepared, the safer you're going to be. If there is a crisis, we do not know how long it would last. And all I can say is, why, make your preparations now and hope and pray that you never have to utilize the things that you've put aside. David, thanks very much for being with us. God bless.
Good night, Doctor.
Good night. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is David Sibley, and and from Ready Reserve Food. And if you're interested in knowing more, why, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, and we'd be glad to send you one of his catalogs. We've known David for some time, and he's a very honest and ethical individual, and we're urging people to at least think about getting prepared. So if you'd like to get a catalog, call us at 1-800-544-8927. If you've already decided you're going to do something, why, Chris, don't put it off. I fear that we are moving very rapidly towards a war with Iran. I hope and pray I'm wrong, but all of the signs and all the information I'm getting out of the Middle East and of the Near East suggest it's coming, and we're talking about a matter of months. So if you'd like to get this into one of our emergency food catalogs, and of course you need to have the barrels where you have your water supplied, and you need the pumps so you can get the water out of the barrels, and you need a water filter, or maybe a Berkey filter of some sort, then you need to have some medical supplies on hand. And we have a book called Inside the Red Zone that has a list of all of the things you should start thinking about getting. Certainly you should have some vitamins and minerals and other things, a good supply on hand, because you need to keep your health if things do turn bad. And understand, we're living in very difficult times, and behind all the political considerations are the spiritual considerations. If you have not read my February 2007 newsletter, let me suggest you go up on the internet and read it, which explains why, from the point of view of the occultists, and I'm talking about the writings that were channeled to Alice Bailey 50 years ago by a demonic spirit named Joachul. And, of course, I believe that those instructions were actually aimed at this time, where they talk about how the master plan is to involve the Christians and the Jews and the Muslims in a great war, where they will destroy one another. Does that sound sort of like what's going on today? Because, of course, if we get into a war with Iran, and we've got our fleet over there in the Persian Gulf, we know that there were war games about 4 years ago, and, of course, what happened in the war games where the American fleet was sunk in the first day. And, of course, they were just games. They could reconstitute the fleet because everybody didn't go down. But, of course, could it happen in real life? And if it did happen, what impact would that have on the United States, on our economy, on our currency, on the morale of our people if we were to lose one of our aircraft carriers? When you get into a war, you never know how the war is going to end. And, of course, there's only one thing worse than a war, and that's losing a war. And we lost the war in Vietnam, and we did not win the war in Korea. Do you really think we're going to win the coming war with Iran? We're the mightiest nation in the world. But then, of course, we could have won in Vietnam at any time. We were never allowed to. We've not been allowed to win the war, the current war in either Afghanistan and Iraq. What's going to happen when we go to war, or if we go to war with Iran? If you have any question as to the implications of a major epidemic in the United States, get a copy of the book Rainbow Six by Tom Clancy. In fact, we don't carry it, maybe we should, but get it and read it, and then ask yourself, could this be what is really planned? Well, certainly, if you'd like to get in touch with us, our telephone number 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage is www.radioliberty.com. Radioliberty.com. Get some of our material, especially my talk, The Forbidden Secret. And we'll be back here in just a minute for the next hour of Radio Liberty. But please pray for Radio Liberty. Pray for our provision and our protection. Thank you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming down the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, of course, for this hour, they're going to be the views of Mr. William Grigg, who was formerly the senior editor of the New American Magazine and now has been working with other patriotic organizations. But one of the most stimulating guests we have. And William, thank you very much for being with us again this evening.
Great to be with you again.
Well, so what are some of the things that you're concerned about this evening?
A couple of things that have happened over the last few weeks that I've found to be really interesting and provocative that involve what's going on with our legal profession, both the sitting judges and some of the scholars who are teaching in law schools right now, and the way that they're crafting doctrines that are going to be really pernicious in their impact on our liberties in the future, and all of it's, of course, an outgrowth of this completely bogus war on terrorism. Dr. Stan, you may be aware of the speech that Antonin Scalia gave in Canada last week. Actually, it wasn't so much of a speech as a contribution to a panel discussion that was being held by a group of jurists and legal scholars in Canada, and they were talking about the subject of civil liberties in wartime. And Antonin Scalia is perceived inaccurately, I think, as a strict constructionist of the Constitution, and he made his reputation early in his term by holding fairly close to the literal language of the Constitution and the discoverable intent of the framers of the Constitution and interpreting the document and applying it to various legal controversies. But during the last 5 or 6 years, the so-called post-9/11 era, Scalia and Clarence Thomas, who's also considered to be a strict constructionist, have both really, in my opinion, cleave to a completely irresponsible, if not horrifying, perspective on executive power particularly, and they seem to want to give the executive branch near dictatorial powers to confront the supposed all-encompassing menace of terrorism. During this panel discussion in Canada, when we were talking about such subjects as torture and indefinite detention of terrorist suspects and other infringements on civil liberties and other unhealthy enrichments of government power, for some reason, Antonin Scalia, rather than adverting to the Constitution or to our heritage of liberty under law, decided that he would take as his text the television show 24 and its hero, Jack Bauer, who's a fictional character who heads up the fictional counterterrorism unit and has become sort of a cultural shorthand, if you will, for the idea of this Nietzschean Superman who is beyond good and evil and who is indispensable precisely because he dispenses with the laws in order to get at the bad guys. Jack Bauer in that program has been depicted as doing all kinds of horrifying things, including various forms of torture. And on one occasion, he murdered one of his good friends, a completely innocent man, in order to meet the demands of a terrorist, the logic being it's better that one man should die, one innocent man should die, than a terrorist do something horrible to others, countless hundreds or thousands of people. And so he's somebody who represents, I think, a completely nihilistic view of morality. It's simply a question of who's got the power and how to exercise it.
Well, you know, Chris, the thing is that sometimes people get a very, very distorted view of what's right and wrong. That's sort of like the idea that they're giving our children in school today, the values clarification, where,
yeah,
you know, there's certainly a lifeboat, and there's only room for 8, and there are 10 people there. And the question is, who are we going to kill?
Exactly.
And, you know, that is not a solution, a problem that we should be giving to our children. And the idea that we should have the right to decide who lives and dies is not what should be decided. Go right ahead there.
The thing that Judge Scalia was talking about, of course, was this so-called ticking time bomb scenario where some terrorist or some terrorist conspirator has been captured, and he knows with the certainty of the location of a hidden bomb, and the time is running out, do you use duress, meaning physical torture, in order to extract the information from him? And the ticking time bomb scenario is like the lifeboat exercise, in that it is designed in such a way that you compel somebody to choose an immoral solution in order to get the person out of a frame of mind in which he applies moral absolutes and follows them to the best of his ability. And granted, we're dealing with fallen man here, and all of us, each of us, has a really difficult time struggling against the gradient of fallen humanity. Our human nature always drags us downward, and so we do compromise, in spite of the fact that we do everything we can to avoid it. But the lifeboat exercise, the ticking time bomb scenario, the whole Jack Bauer paradigm is built on the idea that there are no absolutes apart from the power that is exercised by somebody who, for whatever reason, has this transcendent insight into what has to be done, whether or not it is the morally appropriate thing to do. And that was what Antonin Scalia was endorsing in this Canadian legal scholar discussion a couple of weeks ago, talking about the fact that there are laws on the books against the various things that Jack Bauer and characters of that sort in fiction do. And what he said was the following, and I quote, "Are you going to convict Jack Bauer? Say that criminal law is against him? You have the right to a jury trial? Is any jury going to convict Jack Bauer? I don't think so." So the question is really whether we believe in these absolutes, meaning, of course, the absolute laws of morality, and ought we to believe in these absolutes? And, of course, the answer from the Christian perspective is, yes, we do believe in these absolutes. We should apply these absolutes to the ability that we, to the best of the ability that God has given us to do so. But from the perspective of Antonin Scalia, bear in mind, this is the guy who is considered to be the rightward-most sitting judge in the entire federal judiciary. He's the guy who's supposedly the champion of the strict constructionist view of the Constitution, and somebody who is completely chained and shackled to Christian morality, and here he is endorsing this view of the Jack Bauer school of morality. There are no absolutes when you're dealing with terrorism. That's one example of this sort that I thought was really interesting. Another comes just in the last couple of days from Australia. Australia was the site of a gathering of the Australian Bar Association. I'm trying to find what city it was in. I believe it was in Sydney, but don't hold that to me. But the Australian Bar Association was holding its biennial conference, and at that conference, the U.S. Marine Corps judge...
Hold that thought, I'll be right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is talking about Sydney, a conference held over in Sydney, Australia. First of all, he commented that Anthony Scalia in Sydney, up in a Canadian conference, had justified the use of torture, using the example of Jack Bauer, a mythological character from a television program called 24. And Jack Bauer would resort to torture or murder if he had to, get the terrorist to tell the truth to save a large number of people. In other words, we're justified in torturing a terrorist because he might have information that would save the lives of hundreds of thousands of people. Of course, he might not have the information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or the other thing is, of course, that he might give us the wrong information. So are we justified in torture for the greater good? So, and then, of course, William was going on to a conference held over in Sydney, Australia recently. What was that about?
Yeah, and it was just the last couple of days, and they were going to honor Major Michael Morey, who was the U.S. Marine Corps lawyer who represented David Hicks, who's the Australian citizen who was supposed to be put on trial in Guantanamo before a military commission, but a last-minute plea bargain was arranged, whereby he was sent back to Australia in exchange for signing a statement attesting that he had not been mistreated. There's plenty of evidence that he was subjected to torture. I need to give the backstory just briefly of David Hicks. He's a convert to radical Islam. He made the Hajj to Afghanistan, and he ended up, actually, before going to Afghanistan, I believe he was in Chechnya, and he spent a little bit of time in the Balkans, in Kosovo, working with the Kosovo Liberation Army. Now, the Kosovo Liberation Army, as I've explained on a previous program, is a group whose ancestry is really awful. On one side, they're descended from the Skanderbeg militia that was organized in the Balkans by the Waffen-SS during World War II, And on the other side, they trace their lineage to the Albanian Stalinist regime that took root after World War II. And so they've got an interesting mixed parentage here. They're sort of the living offspring of the Hitler-Stalin pact, if you will. They were people who had been very deeply involved in drug trafficking. Most of the Muslim terrorist groups that are involved in drug trafficking have some connection to the CIA, because the CIA is pretty much the world's largest entity in dealing with the narcotics underworld. And that's true of the Kosovo Liberation Army as well. They were funded by the CIA and the State Department when they launched their campaign in the late 1990s to seize control of Kosovo, which is historically part of Serbia. And they were people who were connected to the mythic Osama bin Laden. I'm not trying to say that Osama bin Laden doesn't exist. I just think that there's been a lot of mythology woven about that figure as a very convenient scare figure. But the KLA was a group that, for all intents and purposes, was working with the CIA during the 1990s, and David Hicks had been with the KLA at that time. He was taken into U.S. custody, I believe, in Afghanistan. He ended up in Guantanamo Bay, and he was going to be put on trial as an unlawful enemy combatant. And so Major Mori, the Marine lawyer who represented him, made a point of saying that the proceedings were completely bogus, that there was no way that David Hicks could get even a caricature of a fair trial as we would recognize in our tradition of constitutional law, fairness and due process. And so he was going to be honored at this Australian Bar Association conference in Sydney. And the guest speaker from the United States at that event was Richard Posner from the University of Chicago Law School, who's a very influential legal scholar. A few years ago, I believe actually it was last year, he published a book called Not a Suicide Pact, which is a very slender analysis of the legal and ethical questions surrounding the so-called war on terrorism. And Richard Posner's perspective could be digested into one phrase. Richard Posner supports the Jack Bauer theory of legality. His idea is that the government, and specifically the President of the United States, whoever he or she might be, draws his or her power, or the government draws its power, from necessity rather than law. And so what he argues is that as the president or whatever figure would be the decider in a given instance would decide, the government can redefine the law to fit the contingency. In other words, it's completely situational. It's the situational ethic that the lifeboat exercise is supposed to teach, that the ticking time bomb scenario is supposed to teach, and that Jack Bauer embodies. And according to the report from the Australian magazine yesterday, a top-ranking U.S. judge has stunned a conference of Australian judges and barristers, that's lawyers, by advocating secret trials for terrorists, more surveillance of Muslim populations across North America, and an end to counterterrorism efforts being hogtied, quote-unquote, by the U.S. Constitution. And he says, so what we have to do is discover the extent of the terrorist threat to the U.S. There is a danger, and it demands a rethinking of some of our conventional views on the limits of national security measures. We should think of surveillance as preventative, not punitive. We should think of controls that have nothing to do with warrants or traditional criminal justice to prevent abuses, and so on and so forth. Judge Posner raised the prospect of secret trials as a tailored regime to prosecute terrorists in cases where there was a concern about classified information going public. Queensland Attorney General, the equivalent of Attorney General in Queensland province for Australia, Glenn Martin said he had been jolted by the address. Quote, I hope we never have secret trials in Australia. Now, that's really interesting. When you have Canadians and Australians who show a better understanding of the Anglo-Saxon tradition of liberty under law and due process than Americans do, but we've gotten to a point, really, where, in terms of the legal regime being created in this country, we're sort of the caboose on the train now. The rest of the Anglo-American world, if you will, the Anglo-Saxon world, is ahead of us now in terms of the idea of individual rights protected by law and limits on what government can do. We've really slid, and this has happened in 6 years in this country, or less than 6 years.
And I think really the problem is that basically we were once a Christian nation. There was right, there was wrong, there were absolutes, because there was a God. Of course, the alternative is there is no God, We do what we think is right. We do what's expedient. If we have to kill people, we kill them. If we have to torture people, we torture them. We do whatever we have to win. And, you know, I think, I don't know whether you saw the 60-minute program. It was last Sunday. It was about a Sergeant Darby, who was actually the sergeant who had gotten the CD with the pictures of Abu Ghraib. He'd gotten from one of the perpetrators. He'd asked him, hey, got any pictures of, you know, what's life's like over here? I'd like to send it home. And the guy said, sure, why don't you take these? And he looked at the CDs, and here are all these pictures of torture. And he said, this is wrong. You don't treat human beings this way. Mm-hmm. And so he turned them into the Criminal Investigation Division, not certainly wanted to become involved at all, but because it was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And of course, really what was so disconcerting in his home back in the Middle West, where this military police 200-man brigade had come from, he was criticized as being a snitch, as a stool pigeon, for turning against his buddies. And Darby said, I did what was right. And, of course, the fellow from 60 Minutes said, but after all, you know, certainly Saddam Hussein used torture, and he did all sorts of terrible things. I mean, did the American MPs do anything worse than Saddam Hussein? And I thought Darby's answer was classical. He said, but we are Americans, and Americans don't do things like that.
Yeah.
I was so proud of him.
I know. That's very inspiring, but it's also very disheartening when you recognize how atypical Sergeant Darby was.
And I would just simply point out that that program, as far as I'm concerned, was a perfect example of what 60 Minutes is all about, because it gave you the idea that, well, of course, it was just this one group of MPs. It didn't go any further than that. You know, it had nothing to do with people, you know, who were at the upper echelons of our military. And the truth of the matter is, an article in the New Yorker magazine this month by Seymour Hersh pointing out that this went all the way right up into the Pentagon, right to Donald Rumsfeld. And there was a two-star general who was called upon to investigate this, and he was told if he told the truth and followed this out right up into the Pentagon, it was the end of his career.
Yeah.
And he said, I had two choices. I could lie and do the wrong thing, or I could tell the truth and lose my career. He gave up his career.
Yeah. Well, he was told by General Tagaba, who's, if I remember correctly, he was from a family of career military officers. And he was very small in stature, and he came from a very nondescript background. I think he's part Filipino, and he's a very devout Catholic, from a family of very devout Catholics, where the whole week was oriented around getting ready to go to Sunday Mass. And so he was somebody who was brought up in a very strict absolutist environment, in the sense that he was taught that laws are inflexible, that they're rooted in eternal absolutes. And what he was told by a fellow who had been one of his patrons and supporters after he decided to be diligent in investigating what happened at Abu Ghraib was that he would be investigated and that his career would be subject to scrutiny if he pursued the investigation with due diligence as opposed to doing things that were politically serviceable in the interest of his career. And he did find that it went all the way up to Donald Rumsfeld. What we're discovering this week is that it goes all the way to the office of Dick Cheney.
And I'm not surprised at all. But, of course, the thing is that he did what was right. And what we need is more Americans who will do what's right.
Yes.
And really, I believe that it really depends upon your view of God. I mean, if you don't believe in God, then you do what's expedient. If you do believe in God, you do what's right. And that's because you're answerable to somebody greater than yourself. We'll be back in just a moment with William Grigg talking about the tragedy that we have so many equivocal people in high positions today. Well, William, why don't you go ahead and pick the story up?
Dr. Stan, am I correct in recalling that
the great secret that was transmitted by the cult of the assassins was that there is no God and so everything is permitted? Was that their credo?
Well, it could very well have been. Yes, certainly they were a branch of the Mohammedan faith, but of course they really had no right nor wrong. You were simply told to kill somebody, you kill them, and they were usually given hoshes right, to go right along with that. But the story I've heard is that they would take these recruits into the assassins, and they would get them a little high on hashes, and then of course they would take them into this wonderful room all filled with these beautiful women and wine and flowing, and they would tell them they were in paradise, and then they were going to be brought back from paradise, and then of course they were allowed to snap out of the out of their sort of drug state, and they were told, well, now you can go out and kill. And, of course, you will be able then to end up going to paradise if you die in the process of doing what you're told. So they were really fooled and tricked into believing that if you kill somebody and you were to die in the process, why, you would go to paradise. And so certainly you're absolutely right. They had no concept of right and wrong. If you killed in the process of killing the enemy, then, of course, this was justified from a religious point of view.
Well, a lot of the Hermetic Brotherhoods that I've studied, and I've not done anything like the research you've done on this subject, seem to have codified in some sense this idea that everything is permitted, whether or not they actively deny the existence of God, or if they transpose the reality by saying, in the way that the Theosophical movement says, that Lucifer is actually the God that should be worshipped, and Adonai, or the God of the Bible, is the evil figure. They all deny the idea that there are absolutes, that everything is permitted. You can go back to the founding of the Soviet KGB back in 1917. In the early years, it was called the Cheka. Interestingly enough, Felix Dzerzhinsky, who was the Polish career criminal who was the founder of the Soviet secret police, he created the Cheka as a counter-terrorist organization. I mean, the idea being that any attack, whether you're talking about merely organized dissent from the Bolshevik ruling elite, or whether you're talking about an actual effort to overthrow it by force of arms, any attack of that sort was to be considered terrorism. And so they created the Soviet secret police as a counter-terrorist organization. But there was a publication of the Cheka, one of the Chekas. I can't remember which of the Soviet Socialist Republics this particular Cheka belonged to, but in the study, the Black Book of Communism, which came out about 10 years ago in translation from the French, there's a transcription of this newspaper article in this Cheka's publication. It's called Krasny Mech, which means the red sword. And literally it said, to us, everything is permitted, for we represent a new morality. And because the Soviet AGB and the regime that it represented were supposedly in the business of freeing mankind from this dead old morality, that everything was permitted to them. And it said, blood, let blood flow like water. And you're getting that same sense from the Bush regime right now, that because they're involved in the global war of liberation, and because they're involved in beating back, supposedly, this all-encompassing terrorist threat, that basically anything is permitted. That's what Jack Bauer represents, the whole Jack Bauer ethic.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, is William Gregg, and his point is that certainly the attitude of the current administration is that anything goes. The president says, you know, torture's all right. Of course, he really says we would not allow torture, but of course we want to pass legislation, and that was what the Military Commission Act was all about, that torture was really permissible and that you could admit, you know, evidence that obtained under torture. So why would the president say that torture was we would never do torture, and then have legislation passed that said you could admit evidence obtained under torture? He says one thing and they're doing another, and what really bothers me more than anything with him is the fact there has been no Christian leader who is willing to stand up and say the president is immoral if he authorizes torture. There is no circumstances in a Christian society at any time or any place for torturing another human being. And I don't care how bad or how wicked or how terrible he is, we do not condone that. And obviously, the current administration does, but none of our Christian leaders will speak out against it.
No, and that's a terrible judgment against the church, quite frankly. And I am happy to say that's not quite true, though. Just a few weeks ago, one of the major evangelical groups, I can't remember the name of it, put out a pretty well-written and compelling pastoral letter, for lack of a better way of describing the document, condemning torture and pointing out that, among other things, it violates the unconditional commandment from our Lord to see the imago Dei, the image of God, in every human being, that we're all made in His image, and because we're made in His image, and because God is our owner, and we are all His subjects, we do not have His permission to inflict that kind of treatment on any human being. There is no Christian teaching that says that the state cannot carry out, at the end of a proper process of law, the death penalty. That's something that is done after due deliberation and as a punishment for a specific crime. But torture is worse than killing a human being because you are effacing or trying to efface the image of God from that individual who does not belong to you or belong to the state. He belongs to God, and he can be punished for his crimes, and God will hold him accountable for his sins, but there are some things that God's not authorized us to do. When you're talking about the fact that Bush and many of his supporters deny that torture is being carried out, and just a couple of days ago, and I was immensely proud of this, a group of 50 presidential scholars, high school graduates who had excelled at various academic subjects, they presented him with a handwritten letter urging President Bush to desist and condemn and renounce the practice of torture. And Bush said, well, we don't torture. And of course, what he is referring to is this term of art that the Bush regime is using, which has been invoked by every presidential candidate except for Ron Paul on the Republican side. This term of art is enhanced interrogation techniques. And those enhanced interrogation techniques refer to such things as waterboarding, which is a form of simulated drowning, which was used by the Japanese in World War II.
And the Nazis, too. Don't forget the Nazis.
And the Nazis did that, too. They were prosecuted as war criminals for using that torture. It was perfected, and the most effective technique used by the communist Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. If you go to the Khmer Rouge Museum in Cambodia, I've not been there, but I've seen the photographs, they have depictions of the use of waterboarding by the Khmer Rouge during the Reign of Terror in the late 70s. The other thing I find really interesting is that the phrase enhanced interrogation techniques is a literal transliteration, well, not transliteration, translation from the German expression Wirtschafte Wahrnehmung. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that correctly. And that literally means enhanced interrogation techniques. That expression was devised by the Gestapo in 1937, and it refers to the same suite of torture techniques, such as sleep deprivation, stress positions, various forms of beating, simulated drowning, simulated asphyxiation, and the people in Germany were prosecuted as war criminals for committing those acts on people who were in their power, whether you're talking about POWs, whether you're talking about civilians who were taken into various Gestapo interrogation centers, or whether you're talking about people who were accused of terrorism, as some of the partisan forces were accused of terrorism in France and in Norway and Holland and elsewhere. And so you've got the literal translation of the German expression to describe exactly the same types of methods that are being used now by our government.
And it was very interesting. On 60 Minutes about 2 weeks ago, they had George Tenet there, and he was being interviewed by Scott Pell, and he said, we do not condone torture. And Scott Pell said, well, what about waterboarding? And you could just see George Tenet's Adam's apple go up and down, and he said, well, I'm not going to talk about specific techniques.
Of course not.
I mean, well, what about waterboarding? Is it torture or not? Well, we're not going to talk about that, but we do not condone torture. And that man, former head of the CIA, was frankly lying, and he knew he was lying. And Scott Pell, well, I will say he didn't let him get away with it. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. I guess this is William Grigg, and certainly this is, I think it's a very important issue because it deals with what is the morality of America today. Have we become a totally immoral people? I believe the current administration has demonstrated that they are immoral, that the people in the executive branch of government are immoral, and that, of course, this has permeated then all the way down to the ranks, in the military. I understand that some officers are very unhappy with this, and I'm proud of them for it. And I'm specifically proud of the Filipino general who investigated Abu Ghraib and really simply gave up his career by telling the truth.
We know after a certain point, you've got to understand that a value, something you profess to value as a principle, is something for which you have to be willing to sacrifice, or else it's not a principle. I mean, principles are very easy to cleave to when they're not being challenged. It's if you are willing to uphold those principles when they're under severe challenge that you find out whether or not you have integrity. And you have a handful of people in proportionate terms in this whole sordid affair who are displaying integrity, and it's very inspiring to see it. And it's at once a real tonic, given that we're so prone to fall into depression over the simple preponderance of horrible things going on. And at the same time, it's a little humbling. I mean, it's always humbling when you see somebody like General Tagaba or Sergeant Darby or these high school students who confronted Bush a couple of days ago about these issues. And you recognize that there is a certain resilient decency in our country, and that is a direct and unmistakable legacy of our Christian heritage. I mean, there was never a country in the history of mankind that had the unique blessing of having that specific heritage as its founding set of assumptions. I mean, there are plenty of countries that are, if you will, the offspring of kingdoms that were part of Christendom, what we used to call Christendom before World War I, which was sort of the murder-suicide of Christian civilization. I mean, they refer to France as the oldest daughter of the Church because it was created as a Catholic, Roman Catholic kingdom. But the thing is, if you take a look at the American founding, you have something really unique. I mean, unique is a sufficient expression. I mean, uniqueness does not admit degrees.
I'm going to have to interrupt you here. Hold that thought for just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we'll let William continue his thoughts. But before we do that, I'd like you to get your webpage out there so people would know how to get in touch with you.
The easiest way to find what I and my associates are putting out for consumption is to go to the Right Source. And the URL for that is rightsourceonline.com. That's one word, not the Right Source, rightsourceonline.com. And that's a portal to our news and commentary pages, and also to the live daily, that is to say weekday broadcast, of the radio program that we do with Kevin Shannon and Tom Edlam and myself. As a matter of fact, Tom Edlam and myself will be co-hosting that tomorrow. There's an action agenda with suggestions for things that conscientious citizens can do to help try to improve our situation. And it also is a portal to my blog, which is called Pro Libertate. The Pro Libertate blog is updated pretty much every day during the week and sometimes over the weekend. And we also have an austerely infrequent e-zine, which is to say that we put it out monthly, but usually at the end of the month rather than the beginning of the month. It's free. You can go there and download it, or you can sign up for email delivery of the email magazine, which is called Pro Libertate as well. RightSourceOnline.com is the gateway to all of this stuff. And my book, From Republic to Reich, How the Imperial Executive Devoured the Bill of Rights, should be ready in a couple of weeks. We're trying to get that nailed down and get that out to the public. There are, to the best of my knowledge, a couple of bootleg manuscripts of it already circulating, and I've heard some good things from people who've read it. They've said that it's usefully terrifying, and I think that's a pretty good way of describing the effect that I was shooting for. I want to terrify people, but not to paralyze them with horror, but hopefully to catalyze something inside them that will drive them to do something useful to improve our conditions right now.
Well, I think right now, of course, you motivate people, you know, they have to give them some reason to get involved. And,
yeah.
And fear is a very powerful driving force, because there's a great deal to be fearful of, and yet, of course, there's a great deal to be hopeful for, but not unless there are enough people who are willing to get involved in this battle. So,
yeah.
You were beginning to talk really about our values and the importance of values. So I'll let you go ahead and pick that, those ideas up before I so rudely interrupted you.
Oh, it wasn't rude at all. But no, I was talking about the uniqueness of our founding, in that unlike every other country of consequence so far in recorded human history, the United States of America, from its very beginning as a nation, recognized the source of our rights being our Creator, and the limited role of government as being that of protecting the God-given rights of the individual. And there's no other country in history that has that claim, and no other country that can lay claim to that specifically Christian understanding of the way society should be organized. That's not to say that there aren't other countries that are descendants of this, or rather partakers of this Christian understanding to a greater or lesser extent. You can go back and take a look at things that were going on in Puritan England, and take a look at some of the things that happened in Scotland during the Scottish, what was called the Scottish Enlightenment, which is very different from the French Enlightenment of the 18th century. You can take a look at some things that are going on today, where people are starting to understand, in countries as diverse as Estonia and the Czech Republic, for instance, and even some of the countries in Latin America, you can see places where people are starting to understand some of the concepts of what made America prosper. But we were blessed to have that as our founding, and the founding generation was so overrun with conspicuously brave and insightful men, it really was an embarrassment of riches. And the founding was an event of such energetic principle and character that it imparted momentum, if you will, to the whole American experience. We're still living, I think, living on the momentum that our founding generation gave us. And what I would like to see, and it's something that is possible, you know, God willing, God's very generous. I think we've overtaxed his generosity in a lot of ways, but he's still a generous God. He'll provide us with another opportunity, perhaps our last opportunity, to reclaim that heritage. There's some exciting things going on right now where you see, for instance, the Ron Paul presidential campaign. Ron Paul makes a point of saying it's not about him. It's not about presidential politics, even. He says it's about the principles I'm talking about, for instance, the fact that our founders had a foreign policy that was not bellicose. They didn't see the role of the United States as that of running the world, but rather that of the United States being the role of the United States being that of living in freedom and using the power of our example to inspire others to partake of that divine gift. And that message resonates. It's amazing. You can see how at the Ron Paul meetups that are being organized across the country, you've got everybody from people in their 50s and 60s who are disillusioned Republican conservatives down to 18, 19-year-old skateboarders who like the idea of individual liberty and everything in between, people of every ethnic background and many religious backgrounds who are gravitating toward the message of freedom. And that, as much as what we've seen with the example of these whistleblowers sacrificing their careers and putting themselves not only socially at risk, but sometimes physically at risk as well, in order to tell the truth about things such as torture, there is a lot of resilient decency in our country. And once again, I say that's something that reflects God's bounteous generosity to our nation.
And I certainly agree with you. I think this still has the potential to be a nation that can be free. But we have to give people, Cindy, an understanding, you know, that all is not lost. And I think that was beautifully demonstrated today when the Senate, actually, because of pressure from people all across America calling and emailing and faxing to their senators, defied President Bush and all of the power of the globalist establishment. And there were enough senators who were willing to say, no, we're not going to go along with this program, that they, at least for the time being, I think, have defeated the amnesty of legislation, which would have been a disaster for our country. So we still can have an effect.
Well, the interesting thing about that, as is so often the case with voter uprisings of this sort, is that it plays on, if you will, sort of the limbic part of the brain of a politician. It's a fear reaction to the prospect of having to go back and confront large crowds of very irate voters who have every intention of taking that politician and offering him an opportunity to find employment in the private sector. And nothing terrifies a politician like the prospect of having to go out and find honest work. And so we can use that leverage against politicians. The really interesting thing about a politician as opposed to a statesman is that a politician is somebody who will exert great efforts to avoid making an honest living, whereas a statesman is somebody who looks upon politics as something he would rather not be doing. And if I might recur once again to Ron Paul, I had the opportunity to share a lectern with him about a year and a half ago and speak with him at some length. And one of the topics of our conversation is, what would you be doing, Representative Paul, if you weren't doing this? He says, oh, there are all kinds of things I'd rather be doing with my time than running for office or voting in the Congress and being the lonely minority of one on most occasions. There are all kinds of things I'd rather be doing. He had a very successful practice as an obstetrician. He delivered thousands of babies. He never killed a single one. He's pro-life in every way that you can imagine, as you can understand from that particular statistic. But like the people who served in the founding generation, of whom I think the typical examples would be men like Washington, you see that same attitude where politics is not the measure of all things. Politics is important, but it shouldn't overshadow life. There are much more important things to attend to. There's one's relationship with God. There's one's family. There's a whole host of talents that each of us was given by our Creator, most of which have nothing to do with politics. Samuel Johnson once wrote, and Samuel Johnson is somebody I quote with reluctance because he's the one who said, you know, politics is the last refuge of the scoundrel, and he had a lot of nasty things to say about the American Revolution. But notwithstanding that, he had a certain wisdom when he said, how small of all that human hearts endure, that part that laws or kings can cause or cure. In other words, politics is not supposed to be a life and death proposition. And statesmen like Ron Paul, like our founding statesmen, understood that. And I think the wonderful thing, you find a politician who's willing to lose on principle, that's somebody we should look upon as at least a probationary statesman. And that's the thing about these whistleblowers, Dr. Stan, that I see as well. They're willing to lose their careers because they're willing to do what's right, whether or not it's the profitable thing to do. And you see that as well in a lot of other areas of our society right now. There's still people who are willing to make sacrifices for principle, and we're going to have to start making some sacrifices. We're going to have to go outside of our comfort zone socially. We're going to have to sacrifice our time, money, and influence to help mobilize and inform others. We're going to have to do things that are going to make us perhaps somewhat unpopular in our churches or at our social gatherings, the social clubs we might attend, if we make ourselves politely obnoxious about certain subjects that people have to confront. If we're going to turn our nation around or even arrest our decline, it's going to require that we make some sacrifice of our comforts. And it's interesting now once you see how people are gravitating toward a man, Ron Paul, who's willing to lose in order to make the points that have to be made, to speak the truth that must be spoken. And I, for the first time in many, many years, I find myself guardedly optimistic about our prospects because of the fact that people are recognizing that message and gravitating to it.
And I think that the other amazing thing is the only way that they were ever able to get enough people writing and calling and emailing and faxing to their elected representatives was the influence of the Internet and of the talk radio. And I think this is something that they've never had to put up with before. There's never been a means of reaching people all across America. So I think that is one of the greatest victories we've ever had.
Yeah.
And it shows that we have the majority of people now. Believe me, certainly, if you look at what was happening, I know my friend Charlotte Isabey was calling her senators there in Maine. And she called this one senator there who was going to was actually going to vote the wrong way. And she said, "Well, what about the calls you're getting?" And oh, the aide to the senator said, "Oh, they're 90% against the position the senator has taken." In other words, 90% of the people were on our side, and they pulled out every stop to get all of their people to mm-hmm. call in.
Yeah.
So they don't have that many people who want illegal immigration. They don't want that many people who want amnesty. They don't have that many people who want us to give up our sovereignty. We are the majority, and if these people would get together, why, we could begin to take America back.
I think that one of the things that we don't appreciate when we're talking about trying to activate the much invoked silent majority is that the reason why so many people are silent, so many people to see the world pretty much the same way we do, is because we have kids to raise, bills to pay, mortgages to worry about. We have 10,000 daily details that have to be attended to, whereas the other side is more or less funded by the tax-exempt foundations, and they don't have these same worries that assail them every single day, because their very meat and drink consists of regimenting our lives and forcing us to change the way that we live in order to conform to their design for the world. I mean, that is their entire purpose in life, is to make sure that we are forced to live the way that they choose for us, whereas we're busy living our lives and tending to the things that matter to us. And so really the fact that we're numerically much stronger than they are doesn't mean that we're not the underdog on account of the fact that the rest of us have to work for a living and they don't. And so if you can get people to make small sacrifices of their time to do relatively easy things, the fact that we have this vast numerical majority is going to overawe the opposition, in spite of the fact that, you know, whereas we have to pay taxes, these people are subsidized by tax-exempt foundations and subsidized by the government directly. In other words, they're redirecting our wealth into their pockets so that they can use our wealth to regiment how we live. And if we can get people to understand and become offended over that, first of all, people have to understand and get angry about that fact. And then to take little steps on very important subjects, it's amazing how much power we can have. You made mention of the Internet. The thing that terrifies the power elite, I think, is they don't know what to do with this new means of mobilizing people, where you can get around the gatekeepers and people can go directly to, for instance, YouTube and get their news from YouTube, from the source, rather than having it filtered through some blow-dried spokeslier for one of the retail outlets for Propaganda Central. And that's having a big impact, particularly on once again, with the Ron Paul candidacy, which is entirely driven pretty much by YouTube. And I don't know how they're going to try to get their arms around this, but if they're going to retain their control of us, they're going to have to. And so when they start talking about reimposing the fairness doctrine, so-called, for talk radio, I think that's one illustration of the power elite once again trying to impose some kind of a gatekeeper function between us and an information source that's been so far pretty much unmediated. And you talk about net neutrality, that's the Internet equivalent of the fairness doctrine for that lack of a better way of putting it. You know, they're trying to find some way of reinstituting controls. It's just going to be really difficult for them to do so, I think. So we're in for some really interesting times here as all this shakes out.
Well, of course, there's no more fascinating time to live than right now. And we are still the majority. The average American still loves freedom. He loves his country. And, of course, the vast majority of the good people are very, very concerned that the America we had 30 years ago no longer exists now. Most people don't understand the spiritual forces that are at work intent upon destroying America. If we can first get them to understand that, to begin to connect the dots, why at that point they're hopefully going to be able to become effective in this truly spiritual battle which is being fought for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization.
Yep.
Because there is a conspiracy against God, and that, of course, is the common conspiracy behind all of these various movements that are out here. And this is the one point that has never been clarified by any of our so-called anti-communist or conservative organizations. And until we address who the real enemy is, why we'll never be able to be effective against them. Well, certainly our guest has been William Grigg, and certainly we appreciate being with us. Would you like to get your web page out just one more time there?
Sure. RightSourceOnline.com is the web portal, and that'll take you to my blog, which is called Pro Libertate, and a bunch of other stuff, radio programs, all kinds of goodies there. RightSourceOnline.com.
All right, fine. Of course, William does a program with Kevin. Is it Kevin Shannon? He does a program regularly with Kevin Shannon. What day are you on there?
I'm on Fridays, but Kevin's on every day.
All right, fine. And Kevin's doing a great job on Genesis, and so you can listen to William every Friday on the Kevin Shannon program on Genesis. And we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program. Well, William, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program for us.
I think you're entirely correct in saying that there's never been a more interesting time to live than right now, for a lot of reasons. I mean, the first of which, obviously, is that we live in a uniquely information-rich environment. And I think that people have a crisis of abundance rather than a crisis of scarcity. And it would be a wonderful thing if people could spend a little bit more of their time trying to become educated, and it's never been easier to do so, and then exercising wisdom, being judicious in terms of what they're reading and how to apply it. And for the first time in our nation's history, we don't really have gatekeepers that impose themselves between people and the facts of a lot of these issues. So that's a cause for some optimism as well. And once again, I'm just so heartened by the prominent spectacle of so many people who are willing to sacrifice for principle. These whistleblowers from Abu Ghraib and elsewhere, those high school students from a couple of days ago confronted Bush, what's going on with the Ron Paul campaign, the vote on the illegal immigrant amnesty program. I mean, there are a number of instances where we see that there's very tangible reasons hopeful. And I say that as somebody who's a professional pessimist. So I think that our prospects are much better than I would have believed them capable of being a year ago.
Well, I think we just have to persist. I think that we have a lot of things going for us. I believe that all across America, more and more people are listening to programs like Kevin Shannon, where Christian Williams saw it every Friday, and like Radio Liberty, and like the Power Hour, and like certainly Alex Jones. And there are many, many people out there. Each one of us has a little different approach to it. But the common thread is always there, and that is that America is worthwhile fighting for, and if we don't fight for it, we're going to lose it. So I do believe that there's a growing awareness. We need to reach an awful lot of people. But everyone who's listening to this program tonight can reach at least one other person, and those people can reach one other person. And on a person-to-person basis, taking America back person by person, block by block, precinct by precinct, city by city, county by county, we can take America back. We have to take America back, because, of course, if we do not, then the freedom as we've known it will become soon only a remembrance of things past. I think we can do it. We hope that you and the audience will join us. And William, thank you very much for being
with us.
It's always a pleasure having you here.
The pleasure is mine.
Good night, and God bless you.
God bless.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that William, Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. We hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And you can do that by giving us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Radio Liberty is a little unusual. Of course, we have 5 hours a day. You can get us somewhere in the country on internet. 4 hours a day on shortwave. 9 hours a day on Telstar 5. And, Sydney, we depend upon those of you in the listening audience to help us. We can't do this without you. But we have people out there who are willing to sacrifice to join the Radio Liberty family and give sacrificially. And if you agree with us, you'd like to be part of our team, we'd love to hear from you. Now, first, if you really want to understand what's going on, you need to listen to my talk or read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need, of course, to get our new talk on the Forbidden Secret. You need to get to understand four tape sets, either four tape sets or four CD sets, the movement which is sweeping America called The Secret. And, of course, that is the four tape set is called The Secret, Behind the Secret. You'll want to get that. You'll want to watch it. You'll want to understand what is really going on. There is a movement that is infiltrating the Christian church that is to take people into contact with the other dimension. And there is a spiritual dimension. You can contact that spiritual dimension through mediums and fortune tellers and diviners and through astrologers, and but do not do it. Because, of course, we are forbidden in the Bible to do it. And the longer I live, the more convinced I am of the fact that the Bible is true and is accurate. And the admonitions and the instructions that are given there are absolutely right. There are two basic philosophies. Either there is a God and we are to obey God and fear God and love God and obey His commandments, or we are the center of the universe. And, of course, we can do whatever we want to because we are God. And that's basically the two ideas, and that's the idea of Rhonda Byrne's secret and of Esther Hicks and all the people who support this, that we can become as God, and we can do whatever we want to. And ladies and gentlemen, if you take that attitude, you may get tremendous power, you may get tremendous wealth, and you'll spend eternity in hell and in punishment. I'm not joking about this. You need to get our four tapes or four D set called The Secret, Behind the Secret. And then, of course, if you have not yet made your preparations, if you'd like to get an emergency food catalog, or you'd like, of course, to get one of our health catalogs, or just a regular catalog, why, we'll be glad to send it to you. You go to our website at RadioLiberty.com, like a free newsletter. You haven't had one before. Our number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. If you think you understand what's going on in the world, well, we hope you'll start reading our newsletters. Go back and read our past newsletters. You want to know why we're in the Middle East today? Well, you want to read our newsletters. We tell you why we're there. We tell you what really happened September 11th, 2001, and it's not what you've been told at all. Anyway, of course, please pray for America, pray for revival, pray for our leaders and our ministers, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. And so until tomorrow, when we'll be back again at the same time here at Radio Liberty, may the Lord be with you.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.